To all who shall see these presents, greetings. I'm Adam Best. This is Veterans in the Wild.
Reveille, reveille, reveille. Welcome to another show, ladies and gentlemen. We have a very important show today, a topic that is very near and dear to all veterans, and great information coming. We are talking about homelessness, a topic that does definitely affect our veterans, and we have a 21-year Air Force veteran with us today, Tracy Dobbins. Welcome, Tracy.
Thank you, Adam. Appreciate you having me today.
And so, can you tell us, we'll start off, obviously, with you joined the Air Force. What prompted that, the major life decision?
Well, I think, like a lot of people at, 19, 20 years of age, I just was trying to, figure out what the heck I wanted to do with my life. And, I did the college thing for a little while and, not to use the old cliche, but I felt like I was wasting my parents' money and not getting a lot out of it. And I thought, I really want to, and my dad was a Vietnam veteran, so I really respected service. And I thought, I want to go and I want to serve my country and I want to do something that was bigger than me, I wanted to go out and experience life and try to better understand my purpose. And I thought that was just the best way to do it, honestly.
Makes sense. Yeah, definitely. And it seems like the Air Force showed you the world. You were stationed one or two places, right?
Yeah, I started off and I'll be honest. And I guess it's like most people, I didn't really know what I was getting into as far as, whether if it's in the Air Force, we call it AFSC, but, the Army call it MOS. But as far as the job, I really didn't know. When I signed up, they said, hey, you're going to be working on nuclear weapons. And I thought, okay. they were like, yeah, you're going to go to school for 4 months or whatnot, and you're going to learn. It's very technical. I kept that word kept ringing in my ear was, technical and science. And I'm like, man, that sounds really good. I think I'm not the smartest tool by any means, but man, I'm a hard worker. So I can learn this stuff. So I did that. And, lo and behold, I wound up in, an F.E. Warren Air Force Base, Cheyenne, Wyoming. Wow. And being originally from Virginia, I wasn't used to the cold, the plains, the prairies. And, I should have realized, okay, nuclear weapons, nuclear silos equals out in the middle of nowhere. Guess where I was. Right. So there I was. And, I did that for about 4 years, and it was very challenging job. It was 14, 16 hour days, out in the middle of nowhere, and, very technical, which was good. But I learned a few months into the assignment that was the only bases that I could go to were cold. So they told me with your job, well, I should have realized this beginning anyway, but with your job, you can only go to North Dakota, South Dakota, stay here in Wyoming. And I think at the time that was it. And I was like, wow, man, I wish I would have made a lot better decisions. I wish I would have made a lot better decisions.
They didn't tell you that little detail, did they?
No, it's kind of like, hey, you don't know what you don't know, right? And yep. As you go through and you figure it out, and I realized that, and I said, okay, well, guess what? We're coming up on our reenlistment, and I have a decision to make. So my decision was that I was going to try and retrain or trying to get a new job. So I thought, I'm going to get a new job. Or if not, then I'm probably going to go ahead and get out because I just don't see myself doing this for an extended amount of time.
Can we ask you, though, about the... Can we pause here?
Yeah. Sure.
You're in the middle of nowhere, and obviously with nuclear silos, there's probably a ton of security. But was that a... was there a lot of camaraderie? Was that a very tight-knit unit because you're in the middle of nowhere there?
I assume you kind of only had...
Yeah, just pretty much the Air Force base around you and...
Yeah. So it was... So everybody, we were on teams. So I want to say you were on a team of maybe 10 to 12 individuals. So we were really tight because we were basically going out and doing this job every day out in the middle of nowhere together as a team. And, you know, I can recall going out 6-7 days in a row. Just nonstop. And it was, like I said, it was pretty challenging, but it did kind of put us in a position to where we, you know, we had to depend on each other and it was a lot to do. And we became really tight and really close, from that. So yeah, I really appreciated that aspect of it.
Okay. But you switched, rates, or I guess the Navy calls it rates. You switched your job after that.
Right. So, trying to learn how things worked in the military, you know, and, you just stumble upon these different, people in your life that, provide opportunities. So I met an individual who worked at, personnelist. I met this personnelist and, he goes, "Hey, why don't you put in, there's special duties you can do. I want you to do these special duties." And I'm like, nobody's told me about this. I don't know. So anyway, long story short, he, showed me how to apply for special duties. I put in for a position that was, it's like a courier or they call it like a postal position that was in Panama. And, lo and behold, I'm sitting in Wyoming one afternoon and, they drop this paper, give it to me and it says, "You got an assignment to Panama." And I was like, I was floored,
Good Florida. Bad Florida.
No, I was great. I was ecstatic. I was like, man, this is going to be awesome. This is going to be great. And, I went to school, had to go to school at Fort Jackson, South Carolina for, I think it was a month long school before I went. And, as soon as I get this assignment and as soon as people hear about this, everybody and their brothers coming to me going, "Hey dude, hook me," or "How did you do this?" And I'm like, this is what I did and, try it out, man. I hope it works out for you.
Yep.
But, I always tell people, in 48 hours, I went from, it was around zero in Cheyenne, Wyoming to 95 degrees playing softball on the Panama Canal.
Wow.
48 hours. Right. So that really, that experience really helped me. I'd say personally is because I thought, this is what I love about the military is that even if you get into a job or you get into a unit or whatever that really doesn't fit you or just something, you don't like it or whatever it is, don't worry, man. You're gonna leave in like a year or two anyway. You're gonna PCS or you're gonna transfer. So, don't worry about it. There's always a new opportunity on the horizon, and that's what it kind of instilled in me. As I thought, I love this, man, because there's so many things out here to do and just experiences, and that's what I really loved about it.
And so you got to Panama, I think you said, during a very important time in our history.
Yeah. So I got there in 1996 and, So at that time, we were getting towards the latter end of the Panama Canal Treaty. So per the treaty, the United States was to hand over all military installations and to include the Panama Canal over to back to the country of Panama on 31 December 1999. So when I got there in 96, it was I had no idea. We had a lot of military bases in Panama. We had, two Air Force bases. We had Navy base. We had Rodman Naval Station. We had a Marine barracks. And we had, three or four Army bases.
Wow.
So if you ever looked at Panama, Panama is not a huge place. And we had a lot of military bases there. So it was a very dynamic time because I got there in 96, like I said, and they were in negotiations to where, hey, are we going to extend? Are we going to try and work it out to where we have a just maybe one base or whatever? So it was a lot of unknowns for everybody that was stationed there. And I quickly realized when I got there, there were people that had been stationed there for 10, 15 years.
Our military?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Or they either, been there that long, or they would do like 5 years. And then they would go to Korea for maybe a year, and then they get their follow-on back there.
Yep.
So it was a lot. So, you think about that. You think you've got a lot of people that have been there for a while. You've got a lot of families. You think about the stability of, hey, we've got our families and our kids. Here we are. Are we going to stay here or not? Or are we just going to pull out and leave? So that was going on. And overall, I think the Air Force, I know, did a good job of keeping people informed, trying to give as much information as early as possible. Some of the people that I thought got a great deal out of this was they were sending people to do 1 year remotes in Panama, instead of, there was a lot of people that were, they were coming up on their Korea assignment. Like, hey, you're up next to go to Korea for 1 year, but then they were getting Panama for 1 year.
Yeah, I would take that too. Like,
I'm like, man, you got a deal. But anyway, here we get into 1998-ish, and they came down, the government says, hey, we're pulling out. We'll start moving everything out. And it did. Everything, people started PCSing out, started handing over different installations or whatnot. And I left there in April of 99, and they had already closed the runway at Howard Air Force Base at that time. So it moved like real quick. And it was really sad because, there's just so much history, as far as the canal is concerned and the military bases and just everything. It's just incredible history of a lot of military service and families. And it was sad, but that what it is what it is.
I can speak from the Navy side, the strategic importance of Panama is definitely not to be understated.
Because getting
through the canal and be able to drive through that, one area of locks instead of going all the way around South America. Yeah, it saves.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I think it saves 3 weeks of travel or maybe 13 days of travel. So
something like that. It's a lot.
Yeah, yeah. And we did.
It's a lot.
We did exercises with, I think, 12 countries on how we would actually still, this was 2009. So they've had control back of the canal for 9 years, 10 years at this point. Mm-hmm. But we're still involved with how would we defend it? How would we help them? How would other countries? Because everyone's still concerned of, you know, that's a very important place in the world, just like the Suez Canal, just like a lot of different pinch points. And I guess, you know, from an operational perspective, like the canal is definitely.
Yeah, absolutely.
Critical. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. It, I mean, you had, you know, you had a full Air Force base. You had the, like a Rodman Naval Station, which, you know, a lot of ships that were, coming through, you know, that was a port for them. On the other end of the Panama Canal, we had Fort Sherman, which was Army jungle training. For the Army, mm-hmm. which they were bringing soldiers down every, you know, couple of months, and they would go through jungle. So a lot of strategic opportunities there for training and like you were talking about with positioning, it is a huge area, and because even with Howard Air Force Base. You know, aircraft that were, you know, doing different things down in South America, you know, that was Howard Air Force Base was the hub for that.
Yep.
You know, so it was just a central place that kind of, you know, was the, I'd say kind of the nucleus for military operations for Central and South America. And, it's no longer there. So it's a big deal.
Did you go through the canal when you were there at all? I assume
I did. And, I'd tell anybody, if you ever have the opportunity to go do that, and you can actually, you can go do a cruise through that thing.
Yes.
Not just the beauty of it, but the construction and the logistics of it, of how you put a boat in a lock and then you raise this thing up, how many other feet, and then you push it out. It's amazing. Yep. it's absolutely incredible. So I would highly encourage anybody, if you ever have an opportunity, to go check that out.
And I'm sure, I'm guessing, but I think it was built the 20s, the 30s.
It was a long time ago. I don't know if there were other countries that were working on it, and then, you know, with dengue fever and a lot of other issues, the U.S. came in and we actually finished it.
Yes.
So, you know, and here's something else I didn't mention too, and that I learned when I got there. So up until that, with that Panama Canal Treaty, the U.S. and Panama kind of jointly operated the canal, and they had established what's called the Panama Canal Zone. So there was a zone that ran along the canal where I think a lot of the areas where you couldn't go into those areas unless you were an employee or, you know, a military, U.S. military or a Panama Canal employee. So they had their own kind of like, it was kind of like an American zone. So you had, you know, American schools, you had all of these resources in that zone, and I never knew any of that before I got there.
Yep.
You know, you hear people refer to people as, they call them Zonians, and then when they say Zonians, they're meaning Panama. You know, they were born in the Panama Canal Zone, and you know they grew up in the Panama Canal Zone. It's really interesting. They've got some websites out there. It's pretty interesting. Hmm.
So then you mentioned a lot of the Air Force was stationed in South Korea too, and you got some time there.
I did. I did 1 year at Kunsan Air Base, which is Kunsan, South Korea. And the interesting part of it was I'll call it our detailer or assignment person, but I called our assignment person and I said, and what happened was, when I left Panama, I retrained into being an intelligence analyst. And then out of that, I called our assignment person and I said, I want to go to Kunsan, South Korea. And he was like, you're like the favorite phone call of the day, man. Yep. You're my favorite person right now. Cause nobody, you know, for the Air Force at that time, cause this was pre OIFOE. So at the time it was like, you know, that's kind of, and I said, hey, I want to go. And people asked me like, why in the world? And I said, you know what? I'm in this new, job. You know, I've retrained into a new job or AFSC for us. And I want to go to the hardest place where right now, wherever it's a hard, because if I can go there, I can learn the fastest. I can learn quick. And that's what I want to do. That's what I want to do. And sure enough, they were, man, I think I had an assignment written like 2 days. Yeah. You know, but, yeah, so I went there and, I was assigned to the 35th Fighter Squadron, Pantons, and holy moly, I showed up pretty pretty young in the intel AFSC, and I'm sitting there in a squadron with 20 fighter pilots trying to figure out where in the heck do I fit into this whole scheme of things, you know? But it's actually a life-changing experience, I would say, because I learned so much from those guys. And once they found out that I was all in, you know, I'm putting in 12-hour, 14-hour days, we're doing exercises. Once they found out I was all in, they treated me like family. They treated me like one of them. I learned so much from it because I saw the mentality of everything is about priorities. So, you know, everything's about, you know, from their perspective was everything's about threat prioritization. Whatever's the highest threat is what I'm focused on right now. And then I kind of walk through that and I'm always constantly evaluating that. And so that really left an impression on me, because when you're multitasking or you're dealing with problem sets, to try to, I guess, view it in that way is, hey, you know, what's the highest priority? What's the highest threat? And then I'll start to work backwards from there. But then I'll continuously do that. And another thing that really left an impression on me was don't worry about things that you can't control. Yeah. So, you know, it's like, you know, for me, I'll speak for myself, you know, I would worry about this, or I worry about that, or how am I going to do it? How's this going to, listen, I can't control that. So why am I spending time thinking about that or addressing that when I can't control that? I need to worry about what I can control and then do the best I can to manage those things. And that's what I learned working with those fighter pilots, because in an aircraft, you're going 350 knots and everything is fast. Everything is decisions. And that's the mentality of it, is you have to be able to make continuously work through that process, figure out what's a priority, what's not a priority right now, and continuously do that. And that really helped me a lot. Now, I will say I became a less of a good listener. I will say that, you know, everything's fast. Everything's tell me what I need to know right now. I don't care about it. I've got so many numbers and figures in my brain. I'm talking from a fighter pilot perspective. I've got so many numbers and statistics in my brain. I only want to hear what I care about. Yep. That's it. So for me, that kind of pushed me over into the not so good listener side of the house, where I'm just like, somebody's talking to me and I'm like, I don't care. Just tell me this, you know? And then, you know, and people that didn't work in that world or that environment would go, dang, dude, I'm just trying to, and I'm like, you know what? Yeah, you're right. I need to, I need to back it down a little bit and start listening a little bit better.
Well, we're actually going to take a pause here. I think I'm going to bring my wife in, and we're going to have you explain this same concept to her.
Listen, I don't want anything to do with that.
No, no. I'm just going to put her in the seat here. You're going to explain everything to her, and my life will hopefully change for the better.
Oh, man. That's fun. Awesome.
So, a very important question.
Yes.
Have you ever puked in an F-16? I think I would.
Puke. Would you? Yeah, I did. I have.
What was that ride like?
It was incredible. And that was actually at Kunsan, South Korea. And as an intel person assigned to a squadron, they had a program. It's called a familiarization program, if I can pronounce it. But so what it is like, it's hey, they allocate a seat. So, you know, we have jets with two seats. So they allocate a back seat like once a month, I think it was, where you either an intel analyst or a crew chief or somebody can go and fly on a mission, because you need to understand what these guys are dealing with and what they're doing.
Yes.
So I got the opportunity to do that. And I tell you, I didn't know until later on that the flight that I was on was called a pit and go, which means that you're going to fly about a, I don't know, 50-minute sortie. Then you're going to return to base, slide into the flows, gas the jet back up, and then go fly the sortie again. Hmm. So after the first sortie, I was smoked, and I had gone through. I want to say I'd went through like two bags, and I had the bags in my zipper on the flight suit right up there on my chest, so I could easy access. I was prepared, easy access. Do the daggone thing, and then put it back in there, zip it up, so I'm not getting stuff all over the place, because that's like the last thing I want to do. And sure enough, man, I did, and we were going back to base. I'm like, you know what, this has been awesome. I actually felt better after I had actually thrown up, but we got back and we flew, parked in the fuel line, and I'm like, hey, man, what are we doing? He goes, we're going to gas up. We're going to do it again. And I was like, what? He goes, yeah. He goes, this is a pit and go, man. They didn't tell you. Oh, by the way, they didn't tell you. And I said, absolutely not. He goes, how you doing? I says, I'm in a hurt locker, but I'm going to push through. And luckily, I didn't need another bag. But when I got back, it literally took – It took about 24 hours for my vision to correct.
Yes.
And I felt like I had gone through about a 3-hour workout, where my stomach, was G straining, my stomach was sore, my back. I mean, I was smoked. I was smoked for about 24 hours. And but I wouldn't trade for nothing. I would trade for nothing. But it did, it gave me perspective of what these guys go through. And it's so, what blew me away is these guys were strapping in to, several million-dollar jet and flying a mission, just like I would come into work and sit at my desk and work at my computer. Blew me away.
Yes.
It was so natural, it was so much muscle memory, so much just of that natural process. It's like nothing. It's amazing.
Yes. And I think I haven't been in a fighter plane, but I think they actually wear compression clothing to keep their blood flowing.
Right.
Because the G-forces.
Yeah, Yeah, the G suit, it basically pumps air and you're trying to keep all of your blood up into your brain, your cranium.
Yeah.
During that flight, I saw that black closure window, and that thing was getting smaller and smaller, and I was trying to, you know, G-strain harder, and it opened back up. I couldn't believe it.
Yep. I'm pretty sure, I don't think anyone tells this, but I'm pretty sure the pilots probably plan like the pit and go. They're like, oh, we're going to have the open back seat. We'll pit and go that far.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, no, no, no. That was already, that was like, yeah, yeah. I don't know. I might have went to the bathroom during that when they announced that or something. I don't know.
Like, we're going to do it all again. You're like, oh, gosh.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
yeah. Yeah. My closest thing, I got to be shot off an aircraft carrier.
Oh, wow.
But that's only like a 4-second experience. You get so ramped up for it, and you're just like ready. They tell you to like brace. Yeah. You kind of like bear down, so you almost do like a crunch while you're seated.
Yeah.
And by the time you actually realize, like by the time your brain realizes, like we're in this, we're doing this, you're like, it's over. Like, what happened?
Yeah.
So then, I mean,
what aircraft was it?
The Enterprise, actually.
Gotcha.
Oh, sorry. What aircraft? It was a cargo transport. I'm not really even certain. But yeah, so it wasn't like great flying like an F-16. But yeah, to have that much force and to feel that many G's that quickly, especially to fly you off of a carrier, really is impressive.
Oh yeah.
And so you were approaching retirement for the Air Force and what's next? You're starting to think about what's next. What was sort of driving what came next or what?
Well, I was getting close to retirement and I was trying to figure out, you know, what I wanted to do post retirement. And, you know, as an intel guy with a, you know, high level clearance, you know, the normal natural thing was to transition into a contracting job or a GS job, doing intelligence. So I just really didn't want to do that. And, I just felt like I wanted to do something that was, you know, I wanted to help people. I didn't know exactly what that looked like or what that was, but I just knew I wanted to help people. And, so I moved to Los Angeles and was working with a church there and started doing outreach. I started doing things with homeless down on Skid Row, and it just really like resonated with me that there's such a big homeless problem, and it just like continues to fester, I want to do something. So that's when I started working with, and it's probably 2014, 2013, I started working with homeless veterans, and I moved here to South Carolina and just started working with veterans. And I quickly realized the difference between veterans of like different areas of service. So like your Vietnam veterans, your Desert Storm, Desert Shield veterans, and then OIF, OEF veterans. I realized there was a big difference between those groups when it came to homelessness, access of resources, benefits and all of those things. There was a huge difference between those demographics.
And is that getting better with time and age? Is that better for how do
they? I think Vietnam veterans, if you think about it, back during that time frame, they had it a lot different when they returned home. And I know a lot of veterans that I've worked with, they really, you know, and they told me, you know, when I came home from Vietnam, I didn't want anything to do with the government. I didn't want anything to do with federal or anything like that. I just wanted to go on with, you know, get back to my regular life, get a job, and just be by myself or be with my family and go on my way.
Yes.
But unfortunately, I think a lot of guys, and the ones that I've worked with, you know, they quickly develop problems, and they didn't, being that they, you know, just during everything that went on during that time, they didn't, I guess, get connected with resources or services. And I've seen a lot of Vietnam veterans that kind of fell into these situations of becoming homelessness due to their needs not being met, you know, service related, you know. So you've got a lot of individuals out there that are not, you know, technically savvy. Yeah, that's a difference between those Vietnam veterans and like OIF, OEF veterans. You know, as we're a lot more technology savvy.
Yes.
You know, we can use e-benefits and go on and do a lot of different things or whatnot. And a lot of these Vietnam veterans, they've never been exposed to that. You know, so it's a huge difference, I think, between the mentality, but also the ability to get connected and facilitate services.
Yes. Okay. And so you've actually grown into a nonprofit from this work. Can you tell us a little bit about your organization?
Yeah, absolutely. So after working in the homeless community, I started out, like I said, working with homeless veterans, but I work with anybody. I mean, I work with anybody that is in that situation. And as I continue to work through or work with individuals that were unsheltered, I just saw a lot of potential for improvement. So when it comes to, you know, housing or resources, and kind of, I guess, putting all the pieces together. So I give an example of, I saw where a lot of people that I worked with, would get accepted into a housing program, but yet they had needs that originally led to them becoming homeless, that they weren't getting those needs addressed. So I always thought that, you know, homelessness is the result of underlying issues. So I saw where people would go into housing, whether it be through a program or even themselves, but they weren't getting those original needs met, and they would continuously fall back into that.
The cycle never stops.
So, yes. So, and I've done a lot of outreach, and I met so many people, Adam, that their stories is just like embedded in me. And, you know, just looking in somebody's eyes and knowing their story, hearing their heart, I just thought, you know, I've got to try and change this. But I got to bring these stories up to people, because people don't understand a lot of these stories or what's going on at a service level.
Yes.
So with our organization, I thought, you know what? I think that's something that we can really capitalize on, is going down to a service level where people are and services are, and then gathering information, gathering data, and then bringing that data up to higher levels, to whether it's community leaders or individuals that run homeless programs or whatnot, and presenting this data to them and showing them, hey, this is what's going on, and here's some potential solutions to enhance services to people. Because at the end of the day, we want to better serve people in our communities. That's what we are. And that's where Inspire Real Change came from, is we put together this organization where we said, we're going to do a research project. We're going to advocate for change in the homeless services system. And we want to educate our community on what's really going on at that service level. So with our research project, we are actually working with individuals who are currently experiencing homelessness. So there's no, like, this is the source of our data is people that are currently in this condition. And what we're doing is we're working with them. We're trying to better understand their stories, their history, gathering that data, but we're also connecting them with services based on their needs. And that's what we're doing, is we're taking that source level data, we're putting it together, and then we're going to present that data along with potential solutions that we think could better serve people. We're getting ready to release our mid-project report, which our current project is homeless recidivism, which is going to run for the entire year 2021. But we're getting ready to release a mid-project report so we can basically show the data and the findings that we've come up with so far for this first half of it. And I think it's going to be really enlightening for people to look at this and to better understand what's going on at that service level.
And I think what is probably important to highlight is that there's no, I think you can probably talk more about, there's no constant cause. It's not unemployment. It's not always family issues. It's not always substance abuse. It's not always, you know, it's not one size fits all. And we can't just, I think that's really what you guys are going after. It's not, you can't just say, we're going to do this. That'll forever fix homelessness. You really have to understand that Tim's problem is different than Beth's problem. And that's different than Terry's problem.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's, I always say, you know, cause people that's one of the first things most people ask me when they learn what I do is, hey, what's the main cause of that? I said, there is none, because everybody's different and everybody has different needs. Everybody has different challenges. But I think that's one of the things that we're starting to see, even within our research project, is we've got programs out there that have certain criteria. And, you know, there's a lot of people out there that just really don't fit into these certain criterias for programs. So it's kind of like, hey, here's a program and you have to be, this is the eligibility criteria. So then you've got a portion of people out there that like, well, I don't meet all of those criterias. And they're like, okay, well, unfortunately, there's nothing for you. So I call it kind of like trying to fit a square peg into a round hole. You know, it's like we look at it from a service level as we look at every individual. We do a completely full assessment on each individual to understand exactly what the needs are. And then we will move to connect them with the resource that is not that's not rigid, but flexible to be able to meet those needs, in turn, fill the need and get the person out of that homeless situation.
Awesome. Makes sense. Yeah.
So
I think that has long been the challenge, is that the government sort of has to make some eligibility restrictions because they can't just provide money to everyone. So they have to have some limits, but then, like you said, they don't,
right.
Those limits right. Do create unnecessary boundaries, the red tape bureaucracy.
It's a balance, you know, just like everything, but, you know, with the amount of programs and the amount of money that is put towards ending homelessness every year. You know, I think that there are some things that we're going to be able to present, and I'm hopeful that when we present some of this data up to higher levels, that or the decision making level, I'm hoping that, you know, we can get some traction and start to get some movement in changing some of these things, because we really believe in this, you know, and that's why we don't want to we want to bring source level, service level data up to the higher levels. That's like our ultimate vision. So, because you can't get any lower than the actual source itself. So, you know, it's like, you know, that's why we are so focused on that, because, you know, it's kind of like, you can't ask me what it's like to be homeless because I've never been homeless. But if you really want to understand homelessness, where do you go? You go to the source, and then you continue to go through those sources, and you will see the data, and the data will tell you things that I'm sure that we could utilize to better serve people.
Yes. You mentioned to me off the air that you worked for the VA for a little while. As an audience of veterans mostly, do you have any specific advice or things that you've seen a lot of veterans not know about the services available to them that they could, anything you can share?
Yeah. I worked at the regional office for the VA. So the VA is broken in down. It's VHA healthcare, and then VBA, which is the benefit side of the house. I worked on the benefit side of the house. But I will tell you that, the VA has some incredible programs. I think one of the biggest challenges is that they, could do a lot better job at, helping to communicate and connect with veterans, with these benefits. So, you know, I always tell people, and I've told many people before, you know, it's the challenge is not, the challenge is connecting the program with the veteran. The program is there. The veterans are there. The challenge is connecting it. So I think that, and I always tell veterans, your local veteran service officer is like a great place to start. If you want to learn more about services or programs that the VA has, because I know in South Carolina, every county here has a veteran service office, and their job is to represent the veterans in their county. And I always tell people that's a great place to start, because they're basically advocating for us as veterans to help us to navigate through the system. Because one of the biggest challenges that I've heard with working with homeless veterans is just trying to navigate through the system.
Yes.
People get frustrated. You know, people go into a facility, and then one person tells them this, and the next person tells them something different. They get aggravated and they walk away.
Yep.
Yeah. And my usual response that I use with veterans that are homeless that I'm working with is, hey, what they say, I don't want anything to do with the VA. I don't. And I say, you know what? I get it. And they were like, what do you mean? You don't know. And I said, what do I do? Because I'm a veteran too. And I understand the challenges of trying to navigate through the system. However, I've learned a lot of things over the years working with people, and I'd love the opportunity to help you navigate through it. What do you say? 10 out of 10 times I get the, you know what? Yeah, let's try it.
Yep.
And that just kind of affirms to me, they didn't just need help navigating through that system.
Yes.
And then once they get connected with that system, it usually works out fairly well for them after that.
Yep.
But to answer your original question, I always encourage veterans, go make contact with your local veteran service officer. You know, that's the person that represents you and your county. And that's a great place to start for whatever you're trying to do, as far as whether it's getting benefits or getting connected with program or just learning more about what's available to you. I mean, you know, good information is gold.
Yeah. In my understanding, I mean, I put in a benefits package when I separated. It was denied. I expected it to be denied, but then I left it there. And I think that's what a lot of people do. I put it in, it got denied. They let it go for probably sometimes for life, sometimes for a little while. What I'm hearing though recently though is also the first denial doesn't really mean anything. That's just like, okay, that's the start of the process. You can get denied 10, 15 times, and then you get the one approval, and then you're kind of set from there. Or maybe it's something else needs, the information needs presented correct, not misrepresented, but you either need to find the right person or it just needs to be presented as a proper case.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's kind of like with anything from my perspective, with anything that you're trying to do, whether it's through the VA or through whatever the other program, there's people out there that do this for a living. Go find those people and let them help. You know, I know a lot of veterans that apply for benefits by themselves and they don't have good outcomes versus they go to their veteran service officer and let that person advocate for them and help them with doing that. That's what I always encourage veterans to do. Because just remember, whether it's employment, whether it's health benefits, whatever benefits, you know, vocational rehab, all of those things, there are people out there that get paid to do that. Their job is to get veterans and to get them in these programs. That's their job. So I always say, go get somebody else and have them working for you, and guaranteed your outcome is going to be a lot better.
Yes, true. One perspective I always like to ask is, I know that starting a nonprofit can have lots of challenges. So if we have someone maybe 12 months out, 18 months out of getting out or retiring from the military, what advice would you have if that's been their dream, is after this, I'm going to start my nonprofit, whatever sector it may be, but any pitfalls you found or any, what would you have liked to know now that you didn't know then?
Man, that's a loaded question. here's what I would say. Number one, first and foremost, if you are thinking about starting a nonprofit, it first starts with the mission. Like, what is your mission? So if you really have something that's really, you know, in your heart and you have that vision for this mission, then you take that mission and then you have to figure out if it fits within a nonprofit or 501c3 framework. Because depending on the mission will dictate, you know, where it falls within that category. So my advice would be to first figure out what the mission is. See if there's people around you, share with them that vision and that mission and see if they support it or not. Because, you know, I can't do this organization by myself. I have an incredible board of directors that are honestly a lot smarter than me. And I came forth with a mission and a vision, and they rallied around it. And so figure out what the mission is. Surround yourself with people that understand it and that believe and want to support the vision. And then I would say the third thing would be to reach out to a consulting firm or consulting company that does nonprofits and work through that process, because you know, it's not about just going on some type of legal site and filling out a form and submitting it and they go, oh, hey, you're good. No. It's a lot more to it. And at the end of the day, if you're going to do something, you're going to do it. You want to do it right. Yes. You want to make sure it's compliant. You want to make sure it has integrity. And at the end of the day, that's what it's all about. Because if our organization is strong with integrity, then it's going to serve those people even better. That's the way I look at it.
Yeah. Awesome. Okay.
One other thing I wanted to mention real quick, Adam, and I just learned this probably a year and a half ago. There are programs in states for veterans that want to start a small business. That's something that I looked into, and I found it really interesting because, like here in South Carolina, for free, if you're a veteran and you're interested in a small business, they will assign you a consultant. That consultant will help you develop your business. They'll walk you through, they'll mentor you through the whole process. And then at the end, they'll help you apply for like funding or grants or whatever you need to get it off the ground. Wow. So it's amazing. And like I said, I just found out about it a year and a half, 2 years ago. And I spoke to one of those counselors and I was like, wow, man. I wish I would have known this like a while back, but it is a great resource. Any veteran, if you want to start a small business or not, there's resources out there, man. Absolutely.
Yeah. I think one thing I would definitely encourage every veteran is that I think a lot of people don't use their status as a veteran to their advantage. They're either shy or don't want to, I would say over glorify their service. They want to just say, well, I did my time and that's what I wanted to do, so I don't deserve recognition. You know, other people have given their lives for it. So I think a lot of people shy away from it. I know I do.
Yeah.
But I mean, the benefits are there. You might as well use them. I mean, that's,
yeah. Yeah.
The program exists. You might as well take advantage of it.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like, you know, when like my transition was actually pretty challenging. I thought I had everything in order and I was ready to rock and roll. And then when I got out, I was like, holy moly, man. You know, it's like, I don't know. It's like, you know, you think you're prepared, but you know, you find out you're not, type of deal. But, one thing I will say, and I learned through my transition was, and I call it, don't put yourself on an island. I know for me, when I came out, I thought I had everything in one sock, and I was focused on what I was doing, and I was going to do the A, B, C, and D, and A, B, C, and D didn't work out, and I'm fumbling, stumbling around, and I said, you know what? I can't do this on my own. I need to, like, reach out for help. I need to reach out for support. And when I started to reach out for support, I learned of all these other organizations or resources that do veteran employment or whatever it is. I'm like, man, why was I trying to do all this stuff by myself? You know, I put myself on an island. You know, and I was kind of like, you know, sitting there, ended up talking to a soccer ball, you know? When I could have been over here and I could have been in a network that, you know, with people that their job is to find veterans employment. Like, why wasn't I over there? I should have been in the network. So that's the one thing I would tell everybody that's a transitioning veteran. Hey, don't try to do it on your own. Wherever you're going, wherever, you know, when you leave, wherever you're going, there are resources out there to help you. Reach out to those resources, get in those networks, and I trust me, I promise you, it's going to, at the end of the day, it's going to pay off big time.
Yep. And I think that's tough for so many of us because it's, I mean, the first general order I'm going live and quoting this. I don't want to screw it up. The first general order, though, isn't it take charge of this post and all government property in view? Am I still foggy enough 10 years later?
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
I mean, we're literally trained, like, we're all just going to be in charge unless rank somehow tops us. Or, like, you know, I should look around. I should be in charge. So I should be doing this on my own. I should be leading the project. So it is sometimes challenging to step back or ask for help or say, like, maybe I can't do this on my own.
Yeah. And I'll share with you real quickly, Adam, when I came out, I was, you know, focused on these, you know, certain jobs, and I was putting in for all these jobs, and I literally went 3 months. Nobody called me back. Like, no response to anything. And, I got, like, really frustrated, and I found myself starting to lower my standards.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm up here and I'm like, I'm going to get this one. Oh man, I'm great fit with it. And then I didn't get it. And then I'd slowly just creep my standards to start to lower. And then, you know, it's kind of like you go from putting in to be a manager to, after a couple of weeks, now you're applying for dishwasher jobs, you know, type of thing. So, but I got so frustrated. I found there was a job I had applied for. I was perfect for it. It was at a big company, a well-known company. And I said, man, I put in for this thing like 2 months ago. You know what? That's it. So I called him on the phone and I said, this is who I am. I applied for this job. Here's the job number. I want an interview. Bold, right? The lady says, hold on a second. Let me see if that position's been filled or not. She comes back. She says, no, it's actually still open. When would you like to interview? I said, you tell me. She goes, well, give me your email. I'll send you an interview invitation. So she sends me an interview invitation. I go to this place to interview. I says, here's my resume. Here's my clearance letter. I've got a security clearance. And the lady says, you don't have it. And I said, oh yeah, I do. Here's the letter right here. So after several phone calls, she goes, you need to go over and talk to this other office. So I go over to the other office and the guy says, man, you're actually overqualified for this, but if you want it, it's yours.
Yes.
He goes, cause the clearance that you have, it's like a needle in a haystack.
Yes.
And I said, yeah, I want this job. And he said, you got it. When do you want to start? And that's how I got my first job out of the military.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
But if you didn't fight for it.
But honestly, if I would have got in a network, I'm pretty sure it wouldn't have gotten to that point where I had to do that. And I think I would have been, you know, off and running a lot sooner. But anyway.
Yep. Well, Tracy, could you tell us, how do they get involved with Inspire Real Change, or how can they help contribute?
Yeah. So, our website, it's inspirerealchange.org. And, we just have, some basic information from, one of the latest reports that has come out from, it's actually the, Department of, Housing and Urban Housing Development. And, It's basically the 2020 report that talks about homeless numbers, and we have a little bit of that on there, and there's a link on our website to go and look at that full report. And we are, like I had mentioned earlier, we're getting ready to put together some data from our research project. It's going to be coming out in early July, and we're going to show some of the data that we've collected and individuals we working with. So we're really excited about that. And I would just say that, you know, any support is appreciated. And, you know, check us out on social media as well. We're always doing different things. And and we're just we're in this for the long haul. We're not just a come and go. We're fighting. And we're going to continue to fight. We're always going to fight to try to better serve people in communities.
Awesome. Any last words of wisdom? Put you directly on the spot.
Yeah. Reach out to your, as veterans, reach out to your local veteran service officer. Don't put yourself on an island. Get in the network. We all need help at some time. There's nothing wrong with it. There's people out there that are think about this. There's people out there waiting to help you. There's people out there that their job is to help you. Don't hesitate doing it. Go get in that network, and I guarantee you it's gonna help you tremendously. And lastly, I want to thank everyone for out there for your service. Those continue to serve. I tell you, it's a band of brothers and sisters that does incredible work every day. A lot of times we don't think about those who are deployed right now and those who are in harm's way, but I can tell you, we support them 100%, and it's family. It's always family.
Yep. Well, thank you, Tracy. I really enjoyed this. I learned a ton. I really enjoyed the show.
Yeah, I appreciate the opportunity, Adam.
All right. Well, thank you. Take care.
All right, my friend. Take care.